During World War II, Ed Bard served with distinction in the U.S. Marine Corps, first with the 3rd Marine Raider Battalion, commanded by Colonel Harry the Horse Lover Sledge, and then with the 7th Marine Regiment. While serving with the latter unit, he was severely wounded at Cape Gloucester on the island of New Britain. During a convalescent period of 26 months, he entered Georgetown University. After earning his undergraduate degree at that institution, Ed spent 3 years working at the U.S. Naval Hydrographical Office in Suitland, Maryland. He then enrolled at Indiana University, where he received a master's degree in history. In 1955, Ed joined the National Park Service and worked his way up the promotion ladder to become the Chief Historian of the National Park Service. In that position, he gained the respect and admiration of congressmen and members of the executive branch. Following his retirement in 1998, Ed became a much sought-after guest speaker and tour guide to battlefields where all Americans fought. These tours cover armed conflicts ranging from the French and Indian War through World War II, both in the European and Pacific theaters of operation. Ed's new book about Vicksburg and Gettysburg has been released by the National Geographic Society, and we are very fortunate to have copies in the back of the room for you to buy and later to have Ed sign. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Ed Bard.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back with the Bull Run Roundtable after a year's absence, and a pleasure to talk about generals and command decisions at the Battle of Chancellorsville. Now, after the Battle of Fredericksburg, after the Mud March, General Burnside, who had taken command of the Army of the Potomac, for only really one reason. He feels himself inadequate to the task, but he despises General Joseph Hooker so greatly that he takes the job. And he will, after the Mud March, we'll write two letters, General Burnside will. One is, and of course the President has to sign it, and that is to cashier General Joseph Hooker, to cashier Brigadier General Cochran, to remove from command General William Buell Franklin, and General Baldy Smith. The other letter is that if the President cannot sign this order, he submits his resignation as commander of the Army of the Potomac. And on the 26th of January, the President will appoint General Joseph Hooker to command the Army of the Potomac. The Army of the Potomac has reached a new low following the Battle of Fredericksburg, and even lower following the Mud March. The soldiers have not been paid in 6 months. Large numbers are AWOL or have straggled. Uniforms are in poor condition. And General Hooker will address these problems in a masterful way. When he appoints him commander of the Army of the Potomac, the President will write General Hooker a letter. And this letter, to paraphrase, is that the President has heard that General Hooker says what the country needs is a dictator. And this could be a problem. But in spite of that, President Lincoln will continue. He realizes only a successful general can become a dictator, and he's willing to risk the Hooker becoming a dictator if he goes and wins victories. He will also warn General Hooker, "I also know that you were not a dutiful subordinate to General Burnside. I know you conspired and plotted against him, and you had best be careful that will not be your problem too. But I am appointing you to the position of commander of the Army of the Potomac, and urge you to lead the army to victory." Now, if I had gotten a letter like that from the President of the United States, or if I had gotten that letter from my boss as a lowly employee of the Park Service, I would not have shown it to anybody. But Hooker is very proud of the letter and shows it to anybody that he is when he brings in to talk to. Well, he is going to address the problems of the army. The first is to get them paid. It's been over 6 months since the army has been paid, and Hooker will, first thing he will do, will approach the Secretary of the Treasury, who is one of his strongest supporters, Mr. Chase. And soon the army will be paid. That's good for morale. The uniforms improve. The equipment becomes better. And seeing that morale is improving, he institutes a liberal leave policy, while urging the ones that are absent on leave or have deserted to return to the cars. And this works because he is instituting pride in the army, pride in themselves. He will also organize a very important agency and attach it to its headquarters, known as the Bureau of Military Information. And his choice of it will be inspired. It is a lawyer from New York, a colonel named George Sharp. Even today in the Pentagon, the spook organizations trace their origin to the Bureau of Military Information and George Sharp. George Sharp has a brain like a computer and knows you collect information from all sources, deserters, civilians, blacks. Read the newspapers, which are not censored. And he will soon be feeling General Hooker very accurate information on the strength and the order of battle of General Lee's army. No longer will the figures given to a Union commander, such as Alan Pickerton gave to, undoubtedly encouraged by General McClellan. And we can see a man that reminds me a lot of General McClellan. I can see him. I want to get this going. Right there, he's ducking down there. There is General McClellan. After all, he's from New Jersey, and General McClellan died and is buried in New Jersey and has a monument there. No longer will the enemy army be of such size as Xerxes had when he crossed the Hellespont. In fact, on the second day, the night of Gettysburg, he knows Lee's order of battle and strength better than Lee does. I would submit the country would have slept a lot better on the 10th day of September 2001, if he was the head of intelligence in the United States with no computer except his mind. So that is a big advantage. And to restore the morale of the army and also give the commanding officer an idea of what units are doing good and what units are breaking. He will have his chief of staff, General Dan Butterfield, a New York lawyer. And if the ladies are interested, one of the wealthiest men in the United States. I see some ladies looking rather interested in him. will design badges for all the units in the Army. They've seen at work with General Phil Kearny, who before his death had designed for the 1st Division of the 3rd Army Corps a red diamond, which the men wore on their kepis. So now they will design, made of cloth, cheap, and three different colors of cloth, red, white, and blue. Thus, they will all have badges. If you're in the 1st Division, it is going to be red. In the 2nd Division, it is white. And in the 3rd Division, it is blue. The 1st Corps, a circle. The 2nd Corps, a trifoil. 3rd Corps, diamond. 5th Corps, a Maltese cross. 6th Corps, a Greek cross. The 11th Corps get in trouble today because it's a crescent. And the 12th Corps, a star. People who were wealthy, or not even wealthy, like this fellow here, will go to Tiffany's and get his badge made by Tiffany's, which will cost a lot of money. These will besides be good for the men's morale, and today every unit has a badge. They can also keep a tab on the units, and they see the color of the kepi. They will know what division and what corps they're in. So he has restored the army's vigor. They are happy soldiers. They are well fed. And what more, they know that Lee's army in camp south of the Rappahannock, behind far better earthworks and stronger than they had used to repulse Burnside's army when it had ventured across the Rappahannock back on the 11th day of December, is weaker now. They know Lee's strength because of the Bureau of Military Information, and they know that General Longstreet, with two of the three divisions in the 1st Corps, are down in Southside, Virginia, tied up in operations directed against Suffolk. And the President will visit him. along with the president's wife and the army, in the period between the 7th and the 13th day of April. He has also created a cavalry corps commanded by George Stoneman, a class of 1846, a classmate of Thomas Jonathan Jackson. He should have maybe checked with Stoneman and checked with his medical record, because Stoneman has is very important. He's going to have a horrible case of hemorrhoids. And a hemorrhoids is much worse on a cavalry commander going on a long raid than it would be an armored column penetrating deep behind the lines, whether you're a panzer grenadier or a member of the 2nd Armored Division. And Stoneman will lead a raid, and he will come back with very, very bloody underwear and be a good fellow to blame failure on. When you don't fail, you never blame yourself. So either General Stoneman or this man and his other guys, Oliver Otis Howard, will be blamed for losing the battle. So when the president and his wife are there, the president is impressed with what he sees. The army is larger than Burnside's army. 130,000 men, outnumbering the troops present with Lee by more than 2-1. And the president and his wife are going to see every corps parade. He is going to hear General Hooker, who has he's good copy with the press, and he likes to talk to the press. And he will tell the president, he has just reviewed the finest army on the planet. And he is soon going to take the offensive. And when he advances, he will chase General Lee all the way to the Gulf of Mexico and be waiting for him when he lands in California. He also likes to use, when he takes the offensive, "May God have mercy on General Lee, for I certainly shall not." This troubles the president a little bit. And before he leaves, he will advise General Hooker, "When you get into a battle the next time, be sure you put all your men in." At this moment, Hooker is ready to take the field. But maybe his blasphemy, such as "May God have mercy on General Lee, I certainly shall not," will affect the god of weather. Because as Stoneman, with 12,000 cavalrymen, is going to move north and west, and here is the Rappahannock River going up. On the 13th day, he crosses the Rappahannock River at Kelly's Ford. His mission is to head south, cross the Rapidan, and interdict the rail lines linking General Lee with Richmond, threaten Richmond. But after one brigade has got across up at Rappahannock Station, the Rappahannock rises and the cavalry raid is canceled. It will be set back 2 weeks. for the campaign to begin. Now, Lee's army is along, is entrenched along the defenses behind Fredericksburg, holding the same position that Lee had held at Fredericksburg. Up at Chancellorsville, here, he has a brigade of cavalry commanded by, excuse me, a brigade of infantry commanded by Billy Mahone. And Confederates are picketing Germanna Ford across the Rapidan, Ely's Ford across the Rapidan, watching. And on the 27th, the Union campaign begins. Leaving their camps behind Falmouth Heights, you're going to have three infantry corps moving northward to cross the Rappahannock River at Kelly's Ford. By the time the vanguard of the infantry, three infantry corps. Now, certain of the corps commanders are not admirers of General Hooker. They find him somewhat boastful. They find him somewhat talks too much to the press and guilty of cronyism. And these particularly are two men I'm going to mention. General Oliver Otis Howard, who is commanding the 11th Corps, and General Slocum. You also have one commonality with General Slocum. After graduating from West Point and serving the Army, he becomes a lawyer. So they are not great admirers of General Hooker, nor is General Meade, commander of the 5th Corps. And you can see them marching up here to cross the Rapidan at Kelly's Ford. And the cavalry has used the five Ponton bridges to cross the Rappahannock at Kelly's Ford. The cavalry will go off on their raid. They'll do lots of damage to the railroads. But linking Richmond with Lee, and Lee's army will be in serious problems for supply. But that will not begin until the crucial days of the Chancellorsville operation are over. And the ladies will dislike General Stoneman even more, because his damage to the railroads are going to prevent Julia Jackson and the baby who Jackson had said goodbye to on the 28th day of April from getting to Guinea Station till the evening of the 7th, when Jackson has already developed pneumonia. But it's going to haunt General Hooker, because the Union Army has left only 1,000 cavalry behind. And Stuart is pursuing Stoneman with only part of his cavalry. And the Union Army of the Potomac is going to find themselves in the same straits they were when General Grant, as General-in-Chief, sides with General Sheridan on a very sharp argument they have on the 8th day of May. And he backs Sheridan's desire to take 12,000 men and draw Stuart out. Yes, Sheridan will draw Stuart out. He'll take all his cavalry with him. Eliminate Stuart at Yellow Tavern. But during that period that Sheridan is gone from the army, from the 9th day of May to the 25th day of May, the Union Army might well have ended the campaign at Spotsylvania and on the road to the North Anna, but they lacked cavalry. So you think they were sure, you think maybe Grant should have known about and realized what had happened to Hooker here in this campaign. So at the same time, two Union Corps, the first Corps, commanded by General John Fulton Reynolds, and the largest Corps, General Sedgwick, will cross the Rappahannock River downstream from Fredericksburg at Franklin's Crossing. And they're doing their mission. That is to keep General Lee pinned in position while the Union infantry breaks out of the wilderness. The other two Union Corps, General Couch's Second Corps. Couch is the, if something happens to General Hooker, General Couch will take command. A little sidelight on that, right after the movie, after Ken Burns's The Civil War previews, I happen to have several descendants of General Couch. And if you watch it when it comes up again, poor Ken makes a big issue that it's General Couch, not General Couch. And his two descendants of General Couch tell me he's not a couch. They're all been couches since him. So Ken maybe should have done a little inquiring whether it's couch or couch. So, and also will be at Falmouth, which is here, north of the Rappahannock, will be also the division, and I can see all the ladies' eyes lighting up. This, the lady's favorite general in all the Union Army, Daniel Edgar Sickles, and one of Butterfield's and Hooker's cronies, a New York lawyer, and he would not have hired John Depew to defend him from the charge of murder. He's going much better. He's going to hire Edwin McMaster Stanton. In fact, his dream team will make O.J. Simpson's look like something out of the Little Sisters from the Poor. John Brady. Depew would like to have a record of getting 46 capital cases walking and only losing two. You don't have that good a record on capital cases. And you cannot speak as good as Mahar of the Sword. And there's six other lawyers. So he will be there. Now, the crucial day is going to be the last day of July. On the last day of July, by noon, General Meade's 5th Corps, having crossed the Rapidan at Ely's Ford, General Slocum's 12th Corps, having crossed the Rapidan at Germanna Ford, are at Chancellorsville. Here they're almost out of the wilderness. General Howard is struggling along behind, but that means with those three corps, there are almost 45,000 Confederates. It's 45,000 Union in and around Chancellorsville. And the Confederates have pulled back to Zion Church, where Lee has ordered a concentration. Hooker will arrive with his staff, at Chancellorsville at 6 o'clock. Even Meade and Slocum, who don't like him, say he's going to carry it off. He has now turned Lee's position. Still, Schofield and Reynolds have succeeded in pinning Lee in position. Butterfield up here with Couch and Sickles. And earlier, Meade and Slocum, prior to his arrival, had discussed moving on rather than waiting for the commanding officer. And their plan was to leave Chancellorsville with one corps taking the orange plank, orange turnpike, present day 3, and the other corps taking the orange plank road. And at this point here, 2 miles from Chancellorsville, you're out of the wilderness, out of this second growth area with small openings and into open ground where you can deploy and use your superior numbers to a good effect. They will immediately string a telegraph line running from Chancellorsville across the Rappahannock at U.S. Ford and to Falmouth. Good idea to use telegraph, but they're not trained well, the Signal Corps types, and they lay too much of the wire, not well insulated then, on the ground, which is going to be a problem, particularly on after the second in communicating by telegraph from General Hooker's headquarters at Chancellorsville with General Butterfield's at Falmouth. General Hooker is very high on himself and his army, and he will tell the press, General Lee's army is now the legitimate prize of the Army of the Potomac. Lee has but 2 options: to ingloriously flee or come out of his defenses and meet us in ground of our choosing. Hooker's orders are, now that they've opened the road communications across U.S. Ford, is for General Couch to take 2 of his 3 divisions and General Sickles his 3rd Corps, and on the 1st they're going to march from Falmouth, cross the river at U.S. Ford, and that will bring the Union force in around Chancellorsville to 75,000 men. So on the morning of the 1st at 7:30, the General Meade will leave Chancellorsville. Turn to the next slide, please. That'll be number 2. We'll take the Orange Plank Road, General Slocum, and move along the Orange Plank Road. At this point, you leave the wilderness. General Meade will send General Sykes's regular division down the Orange Turnpike, and the Corps commanded by General Meade will take the river road.
Is what the first of
And they have now emerged from the wilderness. Now Lee has ordered a concentration of his army along a ridge that runs from northwest to southeast through the area of Zion Church. Are you ready? And Jackson will turn to General Rhodes. You may advance. And they step off. The first the Federals are going to know that what is coming is when deer, foxes, squirrels, and rabbits and other denizens of the forest come breaking in among them. Not long after it, they can hear the horrible rebel yell. And then they can see death coming toward them. A few of them will get a round off and then break. McLean's Ohio boys, most of them of good Anglo-Saxon descent, will break and run just as fast. So the line is being rolled up like a wet carpet. Some difficulties, however. Colquitt doesn't advance. That's going to hold up Ramseur behind him. So you've got two brigades. So I hope none of you are related to Peyton Colquitt here. As he'll soon be heading back to Georgia for a reassignment. Howard returns to the scene. Bushbeck's men have dug in and thrown up breastworks near Donald's Tavern. Howard sits a steed astride the intersection of the plank road and a turnpike, with the United States flag held tightly to his chest between the stump of his right arm, a pistol in the reins in one hand, and the men are paying no attention to his orders to rally. Meanwhile, back at Chancellorsville, sitting on the porch of the Chancellor House, is General Hooker and several staff officers. They hear the noise. It seems to be moving toward them. Captain Calder goes out, and they stand on the road, and they can see a stampede coming toward them. Terror in their eyes, just like Lee Harvey Oswald had as Jack Ruddy pulls the trigger. They've abandoned their hats, their rifles, and have forgotten their manhood. Hooker recovers very rapidly and sends a message to Hiram Berry, a 3rd Corps division that is near headquarters that had not gone out with Sickles, and orders his men to deploy his men at right angles to the turnpike just west of the intersection with the Buck Road. Slocum has ordered to deploy General Williams, and we can use the next map now. On the south side of the road, and they're busy entrenching. Sickles has heard the sounds, and he will countermarch his men, realizing Jackson is not retreating, and will reoccupy Hazel Grove at dark. In the advance, the Confederates, Rhodes' men, began to get tired. They've marched 12 miles. They pursued the enemy two miles, and Colson's men have come up, and Jackson decides to halt momentarily to reorganize and order Hill to bring up his men. Now, just west of, just a tad east of today's visitor center, are two roads. Until the early years of this century, everybody believed that Jackson was shot and wounded near the Orange Turnpike, where you see two monuments, one a rough cut stone positioned in 1887, and the other a granite plinth positioned in 1888. As little Jim Lane, a graduate of VMI, positions his brigade astride the Orange Turnpike, straddling the road is the 18th North Carolina, with several companies armed with smoothbore muskets. On the south of the road, 7th North Carolina. On the right, 37th North Carolina. On the 18th North Carolina's left, the 22nd North Carolina, and Jackson goes forward. He's going to ride to United States Ford. He plans to ride to United States Ford because if he can reach United States Ford, he believes he can cut the Union Army off from retreat and panic them into surrendering. So the mountain road is parallel and about 50 yards north of the turnpike. Now, the Park Service in 1961-62 could have, if they didn't know, could have put the visitor center right on the spot where Jackson will be wounded. So two recon parties will go forward. Jackson, guided by 18-year-old Private Kyle, a native of the area, himself, his chief signal officer, Captain Wilburn, his brother-in-law, Lieutenant Morrison, and five others. Nine people, and the other recon party, led by A.P. Hill, ride out the plank road. Jackson's men press to a point about 300 yards on the mountain road east of the present visitor center. Hill and the people with him are on the plank road, on the turnpike, about where the monument for Jackson's wound is. Meanwhile, artillery is firing, both friendlies and enemies. Some not very smart Federals of the 125th Pennsylvania find themselves trapped between the 33rd North Carolina skirmishers and the 37th North Carolina, and surrender. As Jackson's men ride forward, they can hear men to their front. As Jackson starts, gives a signal to go back, at a point about 50 yards from the 18th North Carolina, the skirmish line has opened fire, moving from right to left, Union replying. The men of this 18th North Carolina do not know that Jackson has gone out in front. As they approach, there'll be a couple of shots fired. One of Jackson's men will yell back, "No, it's friends. Some obscenities. No, it isn't. Fire!" And a crashing volley will. Jackson will be moving from you toward me. Of course, the flash of musketry right in front of Little Sorrel's head in about 50-yard range will cause Sorrel to start moving up on the side of the road. A musket ball will hit Jackson in the palm of his right hand. Either he was moving his hand ahead of him to push away the brush, or one of his gesticulation when he was advancing was to do this movement. One bullet will hit him at the just above the elbow, left elbow, just below the left elbow, not breaking either the ulna or the radius, and emerge near the wrist. The other ball will strike him about 2 inches below the hypochondyle, the swollen part of the humerus, but not hit a major artery. Sorrel will stampede. Jackson's hat will be knocked off, and his head and face lacerated before they catch Sorrel and lead him toward the area where you see the marker for Jackson's wounding. There they will help Jackson off his horse. Meanwhile, Hill's party has been fired on. In Hill's party, Jackson will be the Lord must want to take Jackson. Because of the 9 men with him, he's the only one that's going to die from his wound. The men with Hill, 3 will be killed, including Boswell. 3 will be captured. They will then get a stretcher and start carrying Jackson's to the rear. Hill is now in command. As yet, he has not been injured. As they're going, a shell of command, wham! The man carrying the right front of Jackson's rear, they're carrying it about shoulder high, will lose an arm. Amputated later, and the other disabled. And Jackson crashes to the ground with a deep moan. And then, if only the shatter of the bone now pierces the artery, and he begins to bleed profusely. They put a tourniquet on him. Then they will start taking him aware again, carrying him level with their waist, when one of the stretcher bearers stumbles and Jackson hits the ground a second time. Jackson will be taken to the rear, and at night at the Confederate Field Hospital, under canvas near Wilderness Tavern, Hunter McGuire will amputate his left arm. So Jackson has been wounded. Shortly after that, Hill will have a shell go off behind him. No metal will lacerate his rump or the backs of his legs, but it'll cause severe contusions, and he cannot move. So Robert Rhodes will take command. They will then realize Rhodes is only a brigadier general, and they'll send for Jeb Stuart up at Ely's Ford. Lee, on learning of Jackson's wounding, will sanction what has already been decided, and Stuart will arrive and take command. On the 3rd, the Confederate plan is we've got to attack again. Right now, the Union should, if Jimmy the Greek was around, he would still give the Union the odds to win the battle. The two Confederate wings are separated. But Hooker has decided to go on to the defensive. So Lee's plan on this day is that with McLaws and Anderson, less than 12,000 men, he will attack the Union defenses where they're entrenched to the south, east, and northeast of Chancellorsville. Stuart will attack from the west. The Confederates will push the attacks hardest on their left with Anderson and their right with Rhodes. But they're going to get a bargain. That is, Hooker decides to give up Hazel Grove, the key artillery position in the area. Sickles, the ladies will all be delighted. He will suggest this is not a good idea and urges General Hooker to let him stay. Hooker is adamant, and Sickles will be pulled off Hazel Grove and take position here. The battle will be bloody throughout the morning of the 3rd. The Union have made the key mistake giving up Hazel Grove. Soon Porter Alexander will have 30 guns on Hazel Grove, hammering the Union guns of Clement Best on Fairview. About 10 o'clock, a shell will crash into a column of Chancellorsville against which Hooker is leaning, and he'll be thrown to his ground with a severe concussion. General Couch will be ordered to take, will be urged by his other corps commanders to take command. But Couch will decline to do it because the corps chief sergeant will not declare Hooker disabled. And Couch can see, if I take command and the chief sergeant has not declared Hooker disabled and things go wrong, I am guilty of mutiny. So the Union troops by 10:30 have given up their position at Chancellorsville and have fallen back to a very formidable position behind Mineral Run, Hunting Run, which they'll entrench. Lee is at his greatest moment right now. He believes Jackson will soon be rejoining him. He will send to Jackson a message congratulating him on the victory which he has won, and telling Jackson, you have lost your left arm. I have lost my right arm. and I look forward to your early return. Such a day of the Greek and Roman times of the gods as Lee arrives at Chancellorsville, the house. Fires are engulfing the mansion. And Lee is being cheered when news arrives. General Sedgwick's men have sallied forth. And by 10 o'clock, they have stormed Marie's Heights. And Barksdale's men have been scattered. And Early's men are retreating southward. Sedgwick can't get his troops together. He'll push forward slowly. General Wilcox of Alabama will become a hero as he takes a strong position at Salem Church. It'll be 5:30 before the Union troops arrive at Salem Church. By this time, General Anderson has arrived with 3 brigades. With Wilcox's 4 brigades, and Sedgwick is checked. The third is now history. On the 4th, General Sedgwick, got lots of New Jersey boys there, and Sedgwick will be forced to withdraw across the Rappahannock at Scott's Ford. Lee becomes very upset with General McLaws, and Sedgwick has escaped. At a meeting on the evening of the 5th, as Lee moves back to attack the Union final position, and the Confederates all saying their prayers, we hope they're going to be gone, because the Union final position is powerful. The Council of War will agree, we'll end up in a tie, or then decide we retreat, we ought to retreat, and Meade will, and Slocum will say, what the hell did he call us together for if he was going to retreat? And by morning of the 6th, the Union Army has recrossed the Rappahannock at U.S. Ford, and the Confederate forces are victorious. They have, with 63,000 men, at a cost of 14,000, have defeated the finest army on the planet. An army of 130,000 men with a loss of 17,000. Lee's army, however, takes a terrible blow on the 10th day of May, a Sunday, as the doctors who've assembled agree that Jackson will die before dark. And they delegate to his wife Julia to telling Jackson this is his last day on earth. She'll go in and will break the warning to them that he will be joining his father before nightfall. He'll become delirious and issue orders. And his last words will be, let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees. And the mighty stone wall will not be at Gettysburg when they go north. And the Battle of Chancellorsville is over. Lincoln is heartsick when he comes to visit the army. So much hope. And as Hooker will say, I guess I just lost confidence in myself. So like all the other generals in the presence of Robert E. Lee, until General Meade and General Grant these Union leaders, whether it's General McClellan, General John Pope, General Burnside, or General Hooker, lose their confidence in the presence of General Lee, and Lee has won his greatest victory, but the loss of Jackson has suffered an irreparable loss that he cannot make good. Thank you for your attention, and I have some flyers on my book and some flyers on tours I give, and I'll take them out since we want to get out of here really decent, because I don't know how long we'll be signing books. So I'll take a couple of questions and then we'll have to go to signing books.
I have a question. Yes, sir.
Well, you're very privileged. You got to sit next to a man of many personalities.
Recently, I'm reading a book by John Keegan.
What's that?
I'm reading a book by John Keegan.
Yes.
It is an American Civil War. And he maintains that Jackson was hit in both the hands, right hand one time, and two or three times the left hand, the left side. Is that right?
Jackson was hit by three projectiles. One in the right palm of the hand, and it lodges behind the skin, under the skin at the back of the hand. The second bullet will strike him theoretically just below the elbow and emerge above the wrist. It does not frighten, because Smedley Butler dug up his arm in 1921, the detachment of Marines, and he noticed that the ulna and the humerus, the ulna and the radius, were not fractured. And the other one, of course, was shattered about 3 inches below the hypercondyle, which is the swollen part of your humerus. So it was hit three times. All smoothbore.
Just one more question. Anybody have one?
I got one. Could you comment on McClaws and his handling of his troops and how Lee was disappointed with him?
All right, at Salem Church on the 4th, McClaws is isolated with the 6th Corps and 2 brigades of Gibbon's division of the 2nd Corps. He, early in the day, Early will recover Marie's Heights and Willis Hill and start squeezing General McClaws, the Union, from the east. Lee is there, and McClaws is supposed to coordinate the advance of Anderson from the south, Early from the east, and McClaws from the west. And McClaws can't get his act together. And now no one knows which ear twitches, but Lee's staff knows that Lee is getting very, very angry, and his anger is directed at General McClaws, because he can see that McClaws might escape. The Confederates probably focused too much of their artillery on Banks's Ford, and the Federals will recross at Scott's Ford just downstream. So Lee looks as it is quite a lost opportunity when McClaws escapes. And if we know that McClaws was somewhat on General Lee's S list when they prepare to go north. And your great-grandfather, in his correspondence back and forth with McLaws afterwards, more or less had to assure Lee that he would watch for McLaws when they went north. And of course, eventually, as you know, McLaws will try your great grandfather's patience a lot, and Longstreet will get rid of him when in the winter of 1863 and 64, they will not correspond much again till after the Keepers of the Lost Cause begin to go after General Longstreet, and they will do some exchanging of correspondence then.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Very nice lapel pin.
Okay.
And a compass if you ever lose your way on
okay.
the battlefield.
Well, really. As long as I'm not following the man from New Jersey. So I'll have to lend it to him.
Okay. I'd like to thank everyone for the refreshments, and I guess we'll set up in the back of the room maybe and do some book signing.
It goes to the back of the